The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, happy holidays. Welcome to our second BS Report of the holiday week. And this is an action-packed one. We have Phoenix GM Steve Kerr. We have the radio voice of the Boston Celtics, Mr. Sean Graney. With both of them, we're going to be talking about the Boston Celtics and how they potentially win 73 games without jinxing it. That's my goal. We're going to have my buddy Joe House come on and talk about this Christmas special streak for the cash game. And then to wrap things up, my daughter is going to sing her favorite holiday song. This could be potentially the best BS Report ever, or at least in the top 100. All right, big Christmas Day coming up. Lakers-Celtics. Celtics carrying a winning streak and the championship belts into the Staples Center. And you know who's getting a little scared about this Celtics season right now? Is our friend Steve Kerr, who's turning into the Mercury Morris of the 08-09 Celtics season. Steve Kerr, you claim that nobody is going to touch 72 wins.
Yeah, I mean, I've said that. You know, the last 4 years, I think every season somebody shoots out of the gates. Last year was Boston. The year before, I think Dallas. Detroit before that, Phoenix. I've said you really need to wait until the All-Star break till you can say, all right, this team's got a chance or not. But with that said, man, Boston's pretty good, aren't they?
Although you did say, you said, email me when they get to 41-3 was your exact quote.
Right. Which, that was our record in 96. We got to 41-3 just before the All-Star break. And that was just, I think we won about, I don't know, 16, 17 in a row to get to that point. And that just seemed like the most incredible thing to me. People told me before the season started, they said, I think you guys have a chance to win 70. And I thought it was impossible.
Right.
But when we got to 41-3, it looked so ridiculous in the standings that, I think that's when I kind of realized, wow, we really could win 70 games. It's possible.
And when you threw that number out of me, I was like, they weren't 41-3. And I looked it up and I was like, yep, 41-3. That is like, I mean, the Celtics, we're taping this on a Tuesday. The Celtics are 26-2 right now, which I feel like is incredible. They'd have to go 15-1 to match.
You're right.
To match 41-3. Like, that's just astounding. But, in the defense of the eras, you guys, you had this team that had this edge during really like a diluted, weird, crappy NBA season. You had a lot of bad teams on the schedule that year. Like, I wonder, with all the factors that were in play for you guys that year, do we even see 72? Do we even see 70 again?
Well, I don't know that the league was that different then than it is right now in terms of a power structure. I think right now you've got Cleveland, the Lakers, and Boston as really, really good teams, great teams even, in Boston's case. But nobody else has really distinguish themselves. Everybody else looks pretty vulnerable. There's a big pack of us kind of behind that group. I think it was probably similar back then. We played against Orlando with Shaq and Penny, and the Knicks had Ewing and that gang. So, and there were some good teams then. I think the biggest thing was it was just Michael Jordan deciding he wanted to win 70, and so we did.
Was that actually something that you felt he had decided early on?
I don't know. He never verbalized the goal. But if you remember, he had come back the previous season late in the year, and then we were embarrassed in the playoffs. We lost to Orlando in the second round, and Michael in particular was embarrassed by the way things ended. And so he was on a mission that summer, that training camp. It was unbelievable the intensity that he brought to every single day of practice, even shoot-arounds. And so you could just see from the beginning that he was so incredibly motivated that he wanted to win every game. And if you want to make a comparison, you know, the teams that I mentioned a little while ago, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, Dallas, Detroit, Boston last year, Phoenix, I don't think any of those teams had that sort of motivation. But I do see a lot of that with Boston this year. I mean, Garnett looks like he's ready to blow up at any moment.
Yeah.
And that's in mid-December, you know, on the road, and, you know, when they know they're probably going to be they're for sure going to be the 1 or 2 seed in the East. He's got that motivation, and that may be why, you know, this team has a better chance than anybody else in the last few years to get to 70.
Well, you made an interesting point about the difference between that 72-win Bulls teams and the other really good teams from the last 25, 30 years was that, you know, if you're a really, really good team or even a great team, you're going to win somewhere between like 64 and 67 games. And you made the point that like 8 or 9 times that year, Jordan just single-handedly won a game that you shouldn't lose because he just wouldn't let you lose. He just took it over and said, screw it, I'm going to win this by myself. And your point was that nobody else is going to have a guy like that because he's the greatest ever. But the difference with this Celtics team, you know, and it's early and I don't want to jinx it, but, you know, collectively, I think they all had that same edge where I keep waiting for them to have these letdown games or, you know, they'll have a letdown half, but they'll come out in the second half and they'll just kill the other team. And maybe they don't have somebody like Jordan who could put them on their back, but they had this knack for it's a different hot guy every game. Like one game it'll be Rondo. Next game it'll be Pierce. In the Atlanta game last week, it was Kevin Garnett. So, I mean, do you think like that round robin thing could translate to basically what you guys had with Jordan?
Well, I don't know if it's an exact translation, because nobody is Jordan, and Pierce is great. Pierce can take over games, and you know, as you said, they've got multiple options. I think maybe the most apt analogy though would go to their defense because.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really, really good defensively. They just block teams up when they have to. And that's the other attribute that Bulls team had. You know, when we wanted to defend people, we just put, you know, first thing we did was Phil would take me out, of course. And then he put in Harper and Pippen and Jordan and Rodman. But we just had attack dogs and we had so much speed and versatility out there. We'd shut teams down to close out games. And that's one thing that I see with Boston. They're so confident in their defense that they feel like they can make a stop whenever they have to. And that's usually what separates teams at the highest level in the NBA.
And when you guys wanted to attack, you had Pippen and Jordan, who are arguably the two greatest perimeter defenders of all time, especially like in the open court and kind of doing that pseudo trap where the other team didn't know it was a trap until it was too late. I remember seeing that in person. I just have never seen anything like that before, especially Scotty, who now I feel like has slipped through the cracks completely. And people just think, oh yeah, he rode Jordan's coattails. I've never seen a guy play defense like that. Do you feel like he's underrated now?
Totally underrated. He was a phenomenal defensive player. Really could guard ones through fours. And I remember at one point during that run, he seemed to guard every guy out there. He guarded Mark Jackson in the Pacers series in 98 when, you know, they had come back to tie the series and we needed to hound Mark Jackson. And so we threw him on him, but then he could slide over and guard anybody else, whether it was Reggie Miller or Derek McKee, or even some bigger guys, Antonio Davis. I mean, you could throw Scotty on anybody. And he was so smart that he'd anticipate everything. He was always in help position. He was the best defensive player that I've ever seen on the perimeter, for sure.
I agree. Well, you know what's interesting? And I do not mean to put him in Scottie's class because obviously he's not there. But LeBron James this year, for the first time, is the first guy I've seen who kind of does some of the things that Pippen used to do in the open court defensively. His instincts, I don't know where they came from. But he's kind of devastating defensively now.
Yeah. Well, he's always played the passing lanes well. You know, right when he came out of high school and in his first year in the league, you know, you'd see him, you know, once a game, he'd at least, he'd step into the passing lane and make a steal and make a ridiculous dunk at the other end. But he does look more alert constantly now, where he seems to be in better position, and he understands the angles, and he's helping better. And
weak side blocks.
Yeah, he'll get blocks from the weak side. And, you know, you can just see how much he's grown as a player. And that's what happens when you play in this league. After a while, you feel it. The guys who have a good feel for the game, they really start to blossom defensively because they've seen it all and they just understand where they're supposed to be. And when you get a guy that athletic who's also got great awareness, it's devastating.
Well, it's like anything else. Once you have done something enough times, you can kind of see it as the whatever's going to unfold a step before it happens. I never noticed that from him before this year. But the other thing, I think we all worried whether he would have that Jordan-like competitiveness, that Jordan just had to win everything and he never let down. You never saw him not try. And LeBron would have little streaks, but, you know, that was the one rap on him, was when is he going to just go all out every single game? And I feel like we're seeing it this year, which is why I feel like the Celtics could win 72 games and lose to the Cavs in the playoffs. It's unbelievable.
Cleveland's really good.
Yeah.
They're really good at both ends of the floor. They've been an excellent defensive team the last few years, but they've been very predictable offensively, and they've kind of been a little stale, a little slow. They relied way too heavily on LeBron, and that's why they went out and got Mo Williams this year, which was a great pickup because he can create his own shot. But they just look like a team that is now comfortable with themselves, and they're playing faster. They're playing with more purpose offensively, and you can see they're really blossoming. And I think everybody just kind of feels like, and you know, with all due respect to Orlando, I think everybody just kind of can't wait to see Boston and Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's you know, can you imagine anything else at this point? It's hard to.
Well, and then you look at the Celtics have nobody on the roster to guard him. Not that anybody else does, because he's 6'9½", 280 pounds. But the fact that the Celtics don't have Posey anymore means right. That Pierce and Tony Allen are probably going to be the two guys that try to guard him. And I underline try. But
that series won 7 games last year, so
yeah.
You know, much like Atlanta, you know, for whatever reason, Cleveland seems to match up pretty well with Boston, and so. But you know what, Bill? Enough about the Celtics. Are we going to spend this entire time talking about your favorite team?
No. I had one more Bulls question because.
All right.
Because you lived kind of both sides of it. You had the team in '96 that had the major edge. And then you had the team in 97 that was defending the title but really kind of relished it. And I don't think we've seen that, you know, for the last 12 years really until this Celtics team. But what are the factors that prompt the team after they've already run to say, you know what, we're going to defend this thing. We have a big bullseye on our back and screw it. We're just going to beat everybody.
I think it's probably the leadership within the team. You know, for us it was obviously Michael. And for Boston, it's Garnett. And I think the other thing is once you've won one title, you just have a much deeper confidence in your team and yourselves. And that's what I see with Boston. Garnett's just driving them. I mean, he's not letting up emotionally. Mm-hmm. They're going hard every game. And they have this belief. They know they're the champs and they know how good they are. And, that's what happens, I think, when you've got that kind of leadership and that kind of confidence from winning a title.
Yeah, I think the two guys who were affected the most were Garnett, who now in crunch time is a different guy. And then, Doc Rivers has been outstanding. And I think he's much more relaxed. He's sticking to his rotations. And, you know, I think the title just had a dramatic effect on him. Let's talk about your team. The Phoenix Suns. You were on the hot seat a little bit. The seat was getting a little warm. It was like about 91 degrees maybe?
maybe 98.
And then, clearly something needed to happen because you could watch the team and there was just an unhappy vibe to it. You can tell when teams get along. You can tell when they don't get along. So now you're in a position where you have to make a trade. Is it tougher to make a trade when the other teams... Wow, this is a dumb question. Obviously, it's tougher to make a trade when other teams know you have to make a trade. How hard was it to pull the Richardson trade off?
Well, It wasn't that hard. I mean, I don't think we were in a position where we were desperate and where everybody knew we were going to unload people. I mean, we were in a position where we were going to make a good trade if we could, but we weren't going to just make a deal just for the sake of making a deal.
You were a little desperate, though.
Well, I mean, we knew we needed to change our mix a little bit, but we also knew we had a lot of talent and that we were going to still win some games and that we had to make sure we waited for the right deal. We were in a little bit of a funk, this was something that we had talked to Charlotte about, maybe as early as training camp. It made sense on both fronts. I mean, you know, Boris Diaw has really played well for Charlotte since the trade, and he's a guy who gave them a playmaker on the post, which they didn't have. And for us, you know, it gave us an explosive score at the two with Jason Richardson. So it really did make sense for both teams. And once we were kind of in our position where we felt like we needed to make a move, you know, we kind of readdressed it and things went from there.
Was it weird to make a trade with somebody that you played with and won three championships with?
Well, you know, Rod Higgins is really, he's the general manager in Charlotte. He's the one that we dealt with. Dave Griffin, my assistant, initially made contact with Rod back in training camp. So I really dealt with Rod, last part of that deal.
So Jordan was not involved?
Well, he was, for Charlotte in terms of, you know, giving the okay and you know, behind the scenes. But I did not speak with Michael well. You know.
So at some point in the process, Rod said, I just got to get a hold of Michael. He's on the 10th hole. I'm calling his cell over and over again. He should pick up. So the Richardson thing, it's not like he's lit it up stat-wise, but the effect that he's had on the team, I didn't really feel like you had an identity before. And now with Richardson, you remind me a little more of the Suns teams of 05 and 06 that were explosive. You could play a little small ball. You can go big. Like, it seems like you have options now. I'm not sure you had options before this trade.
Yeah, I mean, he gives us a little bit of what Joe Johnson gave us back in, I guess it was 04, 05. A big athletic guard who can post up some, who can get offensive rebounds, more than, you know, just a three-point shooter. And he's also better defensively than people give him credit for. And we've kind of got a nice versatile mix of twos and threes now. Grant Hill and Matt Barnes have both played really, really well all year. And Barbosa has really picked it up the last couple weeks. So, you know, we can throw a lot of combinations out there on the wing. And there's a lot of defensive versatility with switching. So I like our mix and I like what Jason's brought to our team because he's really excited to be here. And he's a great guy in the locker room and a guy who has pretty much gotten us. I think he's probably averaged, you know, 18 points a game since he's been here. And that's, you know, before he's even really, you know, had a chance to settle in. So I think the possibilities are really exciting.
Well, I thought that the Orlando game that you guys played, that was where we really saw the effects of the trade because Orlando has that issue where they play Hidu and they play Rashard Lewis at the same time. And you can really exploit them if you have the right two guard. And in that game, you know, somebody had to guard Richardson.
Right.
And you guys were able to take advantage of that and exploit mismatches. I thought that was the biggest problem with the team before the trade is that you didn't really have mismatches to exploit other than Shaq. So it was a lot more predictable. So you guys are probably done now with trades, right?
Yeah, you know, you never say never, but I'm really excited about what we have, and I'm anxious to let this team go and see where we can go from here. I think, you know, it's been really, really interesting this year to watch Terry Porter because, you know, he inherited a situation where, you know, we had a really good team, and yet we had some turmoil just from, you know, trying to fit Shaq in and, you know, trying to move on from the Mike D'Antoni era. And Terry's had all kinds of pressure on him. And we had issues in training camp where Amari and Barbosa both missed a couple of weeks. And there was a lot of heat on Terry And he's just handled it so well. His disposition and his demeanor has been awesome to watch. And he's that's one of the reasons I hired him. I believe in him as a person. And he's kind of dealt with all this adversity, and now we seem to have gotten things going a little bit. And it'll be interesting to see if we can get some momentum going here and really put it together.
Well, my favorite thing about the Richardson trade was when they played the Celtics last year and this year, you know, the Bobcats, they're going nowhere. And he was so competitive in those games and really took it personally, like the Garnett trash talking and you know, was almost like their enforcer and he played huge, won a game in the Fleet Center. I just thought he was a galvanizing force for them. And I remember watching him and thinking, man, it's a shame he's not on a good team because I think he'd really have something to offer. And now, you know, you also, I think, needed that edge a little bit, right?
Yeah, we did. We did. I mean, he's a gamer. I mean, he's, you know, I talked to Matt Barnes about him and asked him, you know, how to go in Golden State. And he said, well, Jason was really our team leader. And as good as Barron was, and you know, Barron was the guy who made it go offensively, Jason was kind of the guy who was the captain, the leader of the team emotionally. So that's important to have guys like that on your team. And as you said, he's really, really competitive, and he's tough, and he wants big shots, and not afraid of anything. And so he's been a really, really good fit next to Steve Nash and Amari and Shaq, and he's finished really well.
Well, I'm happy for you just because the previous big trade you had made was Kurt Thomas and two number ones for a second round pick. This trade was better, I think. Although you had to do the last one, but still, it's nice to wipe that one off. So if you had to pick a team to come out of the West, because I'm not sold on this Lakers team at all, right. Who do you think, who is your measuring stick right now in the West?
I really don't think there is one. You know, maybe you go with the Spurs just because they've got titles and they've got the pedigree and you know what they're all about. But there's a lot of potential with several teams. I mean, you know, I think Utah is so well coached and so tough and disciplined, and they've been on the verge the last couple of years. They could get hot and win the West. I think Houston is now playing better, and they're combining a really good defense with an improved offense. Portland's up and coming, obviously very talented. You know, New Orleans with Chris Paul. I mean, Paul's been the best point guard in the league. And they've got shooters all over the floor and a great rim protector in Tyson Chandler. So, I mean, you can go up and down the list. I mean, there's nine teams in the West that are all within about five or six games of each other. And I still think the Lakers are the favorite, but you're right. They've been more vulnerable here the last couple of weeks.
You know, out of all those teams, Portland is the one that has the potential trump card because they have the LaFrance contract and all these young assets. They're the one team that could potentially go out and get somebody who swings this. Do you have a feeling they might do that, or do you think they're just going to kind of stand pat and build for the future?
I don't know. I think Portland's done a great job of putting together a young nucleus. They've drafted well. And they're in position. They actually have cap room this coming summer, they're in position to do whatever they want. So they've got great flexibility. With that said, you know, they've played well, and they've had a nice run here the last few weeks. They may just want to play it out and see how it goes. I have no idea.
They caught you last week.
What's that?
They caught you last week. Brandon Roy was out of his mind.
Yeah, he went nuts. He had 52 on us, and we still had a chance to win at the end. I played in Portland for a year near the end of my career, and that's an awesome basketball town. And,
right.
I'm really happy for the city because it's a great NBA city, and you know, obviously they're a Western rival, so I don't want them to be too good. But it's great to see basketball back in the Portland area.
You were a jailblazer. Weren't you? Weren't you there for the Jailblazers?
I was a Jailblazer. Yes, I was.
You gotta get a special jersey made up.
That was one of the best experiences of my NBA career, and I mean that. It was a great year for me. Just to kind of, you know, I spent my career in Chicago and San Antonio and kind of NBA utopia, and I got to see the other side of the NBA. But you know, there were some great guys there, and as I said, unbelievable basketball town, made a lot of friends. I love Portland. I love being up there.
But you're only there for 1 year.
One season. Then I got traded back to San Antonio for my last year, and which was a stroke of luck because I was able to take part in another championship run. So it was good fortune for me.
Man, if only you had kept the journal. Can you imagine? Yeah. If you had kept the journal from when Jordan came back from baseball through 2003, that would be the greatest basketball book ever.
I think I have. I actually did. I kept a journal. But
you did?
Yeah, I did. I wrote down a lot of stuff. I'm kind of a writer at heart. I always loved to write in school. And the problem is I've got that, you know, the whole unwritten locker room rule. You can't reveal all that stuff.
Oh, stop it. You can too.
Yeah,
you got to wait till you're like 50. You got to wait till you're 50. These guys won't even know. In that journal, what kind of entries do you have about Mike D'Antoni? You know I was going to ask.
I haven't kept a journal since I was a player. I kept a lot of things as a player, but
all right. Hypothetically, let's say you kept a journal the past 12 months. Would Mike D'Antoni? Would you potentially have some unflattering things to say?
Oh man!
Take the high road.
You're gonna go down that road.
Well, I'm just saying. You know, he's kind of taking some shots.
Well, you know, last week was an emotional week for everybody. You know, the Knicks came to town, and obviously the whole national media descended upon Phoenix, and it was emotional for everybody. I think we're all kind of happy that it's behind us, you know, I know how the media works too. You know, there were some things said, but I also understand these days that there's a lot of people take a lot of liberties and things can come out maybe worse than what they really are. You know, the bottom line is Mike did a great job while he was in Phoenix. Fantastic job. I've told him that. You know, it's too bad that it didn't work out, but he decided to move on. He asked to speak to the Knicks and to the Bulls when those jobs came available, and it became apparent that, you know, he wanted to leave, and we allowed him to do so, and he's doing a good job in New York. He's an excellent coach, and he's gonna do a good job in New York.
That was a very excellent performance of the high road.
Thank you.
I gotta say though, I you know, the one thing I haven't heard mentioned with this is that he basically had player personnel control for the most part after Brian Colangelo left, right?
Right, right.
And then you came in, and then he didn't have that control anymore. And I always wonder, like, whether he would have had problems with anybody who came in, because here he was, he thought he got to buy the groceries and make the food, and then all of a sudden they're like, no, actually, we're going to have somebody else buy the groceries. So I almost feel like it was ill-fated a little bit where that was going after that.
That's a great Bill Parcells reference.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's one of my all-time favorite quotes.
It's a good one, but it kind of applies.
They want me to make dinner without buying the groceries, right?
Yeah, well, it's one thing. You know, I think if you're just used to making dinner with somebody else buying the groceries, it's one thing. But once you get to go to the grocery store a couple times, then maybe you're like, ah, this is fun. I like buying the groceries. And then they're like, ah, Steve Kerr is going to buy the groceries. And then, you know, a lot of the trouble. But, you know, obviously, if I'm going to pick sides, I'm going to pick your side on this because you've come on my podcast twice and he hasn't. But I will say no team in the last 20 years has won the title that didn't play defense really well. It's just you look at it historically from the 1989 Pistons all the way through to last year, and defense wins championships. And, you know, as much as I think those D'Antoni teams were fun to watch, I just don't know if you can win if you can't get stops. Can you win if you can't get stops?
I don't think you can, personally. No, I recognize that you also have to have the personnel to defend. Obviously, the teams that have won titles have had better defensive personnel than the Suns have had. So I recognize that. I do think it's important, though, to establish a defensive culture and kind of a fabric that you really have to ingrain, and that isn't something that happens overnight. And you know, we've put an emphasis on it. And we've worked at it on a daily basis, and we're still giving up 102 points a game. I mean, we're not, you know, we're not great defensively. But I do think over the long haul, you have to establish it as part of your identity and who you are. And then that's, you know, I felt that was important, and that's, you know, that's something Terry feels it's important too. And so we're trying to get there, and we're working at it, and you know, we'll see where it takes us.
Well, look at game one of the Spurs series. And I know that, you know, that for you is probably like game six of the 86 World Series for me. Just, you just look at that and you're like, oh my God, how did we lose this game? But it really came down to two plays. They're down three in regulation. They come out of a timeout. They run a screen where Michael Finley comes around and he gets a wide open shot. And then the pick and roll where Duncan hit the three. You had both guys going, I think it was Ginobili. Both guys go with him. Duncan's left wide open. Now, granted, him making a three was one of the flukiest shots probably in recent NBA history, but still, he's wide open. So when you talk about defense winning championships, those are two plays where defensively you guys didn't come through. Correct?
Yeah, and you know, if we win that game, maybe everything changes. I mean,
what do you mean maybe? I think you guys would have won that series.
Well, I mean, we would have had a hell of a chance. I know that because we dominated that game. And emotionally, I think everything would have changed. But I don't want to shortchange the Spurs either. I mean, they've won titles and they've come back from deficits. I mean, they were down 0-2 to New Orleans the next round and they came back and won. So there's no guarantees. But I do think things could have been different. And I know Mike has acknowledged that, you know, had we won that game, maybe everything would be different. Maybe he'd still be in Phoenix. But, you know, things do happen and there's a lot of emotion in this job. And there's a lot of pressure on coaches. I think they have the hardest job in the NBA by far. And and there's it's difficult. Everything's tough in this business, especially when you get to a high level over a 4 or 5 year period and you can't break through and you're trying to break through. So yeah, there are a lot of factors at play, and things happen. And you know, this is where it ended up.
Well, it's an amazing game to rewatch. I watched it this summer and I just can't believe. And as you said, if you don't have a game seven, if you're playing game seven on the road, you're going into a series, you know you have to win game one or game two, or it's probably not happening. So to come that close and then not have it happen, you know, it's just mentally, you're just broken. You know, going, oh my God, that was our chance and we blew it. Hey, I got to ask you, you've had Shaq for, let me see, 10 months. Give me your best Shaq story. From your 10 months of being on the same team with him.
Best Shaq story.
Best Shaq story. Your favorite Shaq story.
Boy, there's a lot of them. Did you know that he goes to Walmart after every home game?
What?
Shaq goes to Walmart in Phoenix after pretty much every home game.
And what does he do?
He shops. He loves, like, he loves buying just little stuff. You know, he'll buy all kinds of little trinkets and he'll build stuff in our weight room. He'll create all this little just stuff just to kind of amuse himself or to actually handle some kind of a situation in the weight room. He built his own pair of shoes last year. He took a pair of shoes and he screwed in like these hooks into the side of the shoes because we do this exercise with an elastic band where we, you know, guys wrap them around their ankles and then do kind of defensive slides to strengthen their glutes. But he actually built his own shoes to handle the band. I mean, he does all kinds of stuff like that. But the beautiful thing is he goes into Walmart and shops. And then what he does all the time is, you know, this is late at night. It's midnight or whatever. He'll just tell the cash register person, just, hey, these next 10 people in line, just I'll take care of it. I mean, he is Santa Claus year round. This guy is like the most generous person you've ever seen. And but he does it after almost every home game.
That's a great story. See, you know, people, the Shaq Marion trade was so controversial. I was one of the few who defended it, but just because I thought Marion was, a lot of a product of the D'Antoni system to some degree. But what people don't realize is when you get Shaq, you also get Shaq, the personality locker room guy as well. That's part of the trade.
It is. And that was a big part of it for us was we felt like we needed an infusion of energy and some enthusiasm. And we also felt like, you know, Amari needed somebody to mentor him both on and off the floor, where he could, you know, kind of move back to his power forward spot, and Shaq could handle some of the bigger guys that Amari had been trying to cover, but also to, you know, to just kind of mentor as a pro, like what needs to be done, what you have to do on a daily basis. And
has that worked?
I think it has. You know, last year at the end of the year, after we got Shaq, you know, Amari averaged, I think, like 30 plus a game in the last
right.
20 games. A lot of the pressure was taken off of him from a basketball standpoint because of Shaq's presence. And this year it's been, you know, it's been really interesting. Shaq's been so good offensively, because he's in better shape and he prepared himself so well, that we're going into him more than we did a year ago. And now we're trying to find the balance. You know, part of the reason for our early season struggles is we were trying to find the balance between, you know, incorporating Nash and the up-tempo system and Amari's, ability to score and, you know, the desire to go into Shaq. And, it's taken us a little while, but I think we're finally finding the formula. And, you know, last seven games, I think we've averaged 112 points a game. So we are getting there for sure.
Well, plus you have the ace in the hole of that sneaky training staff you have, where you guys do all these weird things you won't tell anybody else about. You can rejuvenate anybody. I want you to, like, bring Artis Gilmore out of retirement, see if at age 55 you could turn him into a third center.
Maybe Paul McCaskey as our, you know, outside shooting big man.
I've never broken an investigative story for ESPN before, but the Suns training staff could be it. I really want to know what happens. I feel like it's like the $6 million man training staff back in the 70s where they're doing bionic things.
Well, when we traded for Shaq, you know, that was a big part of it. Our staff felt like they could get him much stronger and more explosive. And so then everybody, you know, everyone in the media wanted to do the story. You know, what are these guys doing? And it was like became this sort of secretive question. What are the Suns trainers doing differently than everybody else?
But you can't let it out. You can't. It's a competitive advantage.
That's right. That's right. So we don't tell anybody. And no, it's, you know, all the rest of the league, I mean, everyone knows what our guys do, and a lot of the guys do the same thing. But you know, we've just had a lot of success, whether it was Steve Nash or Grant Hill or now Shaq, but taking guys who were supposedly too old or going to break down, and our guys have done unbelievable work with all three of them, and they've been healthy and playing really well ever since.
Well, that's what happens when you use bionic technology.
we know
something's going on. I'm going to crack this.
Yeah,
anyway,
well, you're not getting it from me.
I will let you go. Happy holidays. Best of luck with the Suns in 2009. And I really hope you become the Mercury Morris of the Celtics' quest for 73 wins. I think you should position yourself that way.
I've got the champagne on ice, so as soon as they lose their 11th game, I'm going to call Randy Brown and Judd Bushler and Bill Wennington. We're going to have a big party. I don't know if Michael will show up, but we'll invite him. And yeah, we'll have a big we'll toast our team and celebrate the Celtics' 11th loss.
Well, don't call Phil Jackson and tell him, you know, it's up to you to defend 72. You got to win on Christmas Day, because I just don't think that would be fair. It's a team in your conference.
It may not matter the way Boston is playing right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Best luck with the rest of the season.
All right, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, on the heels of all that 72-win Celtics talk, I got so excited I decided to just randomly call out of the blue Celtics radio play-by-play guy and our friend Mr. Sean Grandy, who could be on his way to making history as the radio guy for the first ever 75-win team. Grandy, how you feeling?
You know, I'm just I wonder about a guy that gets excited about talking to Steve Kerr for 45 minutes, but whatever. You know, it's been that kind of year. People are pretty excited.
How dare you besmirch the most media-friendly GM of our current times?
I love Steve Kerr, but look how excited you're getting. I mean, if that's what gets you excited, that's just, you know.
Yeah, but you don't, You don't understand. He's positioned himself as the Mercury Morris of the 2009 Celtics season.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, it's funny because Mercury Morris did all those, you know, he just attacked all the Patriots, you know, just back and forth over and over during the 16-0 season. Right. And then the next thing he's doing is those hair replacement commercials. So he just kind of
so you think that's where Steve Kerr's headed?
I don't, you know what? If we see him next with the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, and Wade Boggs and those commercials, yeah, we'll know the correlation.
I actually think
mess with Boston right now. The way it is.
I think Jed Bushler could emerge as maybe the Mercury Morris, too. It's unclear who's going to play the role of Mercury, but it will be somebody because this Celtics team, you know, you and I watch it all the time, and I know people think I'm a homer or whatever. I know when I'm watching a team that knows that they're going to win every night, and for people to think that this Celtics team is the same team as last year is crazy to me because they just have a confidence that they didn't have last year, and you see it every night. Do you agree?
When we talked last year, you know, one of the things I said a lot doing a lot of these, having a lot of these conversations at the beginning of last year was how much better I liked the Celtics in 2009 than 2008. And the primary reason was an extra year for Kendrick Perkins. But at the top of that list was how much more I liked Rajon Rondo in his third year than in his second year. And that is sort of playing out. And it's the difference where I think a lot of us who were concerned about the loss of Posey and what that was going to be, we sort of felt justified after the third game of the year. The Celtics had a shaky win over Cleveland on opening night, which is a quality win. It looks a lot better now, certainly, because who knew Cleveland was going to have a start they were going to have. And then you beat Chicago, and they didn't really compete. The third night of the year, the Celtics go into Indiana and suffered a beatdown, the likes of which they didn't get the entire season last year on the way to the championship. And all the people that said, oh, there's the Posey thing, kind of said, okay, you could not possibly have imagined that that team was going to win 24 of the next 25 because of the issues on the bench. But the starting five is so head and shoulders above everybody else right now, and it's the best of my 11th year in the league. It's the best starting five I've seen easily, and that's been more than enough.
Well, and you know, I think we all had our fingers crossed with Rondo, and he was definitely hit or miss, but when he hit, you're like, wow, this guy potentially, oof. But now to see him do it basically two out of every three games where he's just dominant.
And even in the course of games, and you're watching these games, he had a game against Utah where he was terrible in the first half, and then all of a sudden he came out. It was kind of similar against the Knicks the other night, and he's sort of coming out of halftime, and I've sort of likened him to, you know, a superhero when they're sort of developing their superpowers and they don't really understand how to use them yet.
Yep.
And he's sort of in that stage yet where he is. There are times he's not realizing that he can dominate other point guards in the league from time to time.
On both ends.
He'll go through a half, and he has to be reminded of that.
Yep.
And then I said, oh, that's right. That's what they taught me. You know, and in the second half, he's blowing people away.
I think the best compliment I could pay to Rondo is this. I cannot even think of another player that he reminds me of. And I'm not just talking right now. I'm talking like course NBA history. He's very unique. The things that he does, and when you watch him, all the little quirks to his game, and like that little, his hands are so big, he can do that fake behind the back pass and then lay it in. And he's just got like 10 different weird things that are unique to him and him alone.
He's an amalgam that way of all, and that is, believe me, that annoys the living heck out of everybody in Boston because of all these off days in between games, people want to write stories about Rondo and who he reminds you of, and nobody has an answer, so it really just annoys the media, which is another fringe benefit on top.
How about this? I'll give you this one. Fat Lever, but with Dr. J's hands.
Yeah, this gets a little bit into that kind of weird science. I mean, you're like Anthony Michael Hall and the other kid, and you're sort of creating the, you know, the perfect point guard, and, you know, bizarre Kelly LeBrock movie where she's showering with two 15-year-old guys. Yeah, it's getting a little bizarre coming off 45 minutes with Steve Kerr. But what I say about Rondo is what you ideally are looking for. I think people are starting to get it around the league, which is that when you're drafting guys, you're looking for guys who have the things you can't teach. And maybe they held them back in any parts of their game are the things that you can teach. And that's where Rondo has gotten better. I mean, he's been able to hit that shot with a lot more regularity and weight. You know, he's just going to get better. And better and better, and it's scary to think of the potential. And look at what has happened with Kendrick Perkins. You know, you saw Kendrick Perkins walk into the league, and he's you know, the only reason I'm bringing him up because you kind of have Beauty and the Beast here, and Rondo's the Beauty. He gets all the attention. But Perk right now, everyone's talking about Rondo as an all-star, but if you were to take three legitimate centers in the Eastern Conference, how is Kendrick Perkins not an all-star with what he has done? And it's just about finding guys who get it in the NBA, and the NBA getting it means you find the things that you do well,
and you do those things exceptionally well. You don't have to be, it's not like a football player in the NFL. It's very similar to where, you know, you maybe you're a great cornerback in the NFL. Well, when you were back in high school, you were the quarterback and the running back and whatever, but you've, you know, this is the one thing that's going to keep you in the NFL. It's the same thing in the NBA.
Well, in fairness to myself, Perkins was the next thing I was going to bring up because I live in LA and I have to hear about how great Andrew Bynum is when he tries hard every other play. Maybe every three plays. And meanwhile, Perkins, who is on the books for, I think it was second year of 4 years, $16 million deal. He makes almost 3.5 times less than Bynum and is probably a better player right now. He's just more intensity, better defensively. But I think the key thing that has to be mentioned is Perkins and Rondo getting to go to KG Pierce, Ray Allen school, basically graduate school. You know, I wonder, like, that's just such a big advantage compared to some of these other young guys. Rondo's, where is Rondo's career if he's on Memphis right now? I'm sure he's doing some of the stuff, but.
That's a great, it's a great point. It's a great question. And I think Rondo's probably a little more self-driven. I think Perkins, you know, if you don't want to call Perkins a beast, you call him Frankenstein because Kevin Garnett has created a monster in Kendrick Perkins. And he has, you know, he has just followed him in everything he does, the way he talks on the court, the way he carries himself is. You know, his over-the-top passion, foam at the mouth to play defense. And that's where I think, you know, the Kevin Garnett footprint on this team is not really, I think you cannot overstate it.
No, because it's not just what he's doing, but it's the effect that he's had on everybody. And you know, you're seeing it this year, 26-2 heading into the Philly game tonight. We're taping this on Tuesday. And this team, you know, you always think like, a year after they win a championship, they're going to have some letdown games.
Yeah.
This team has letdown halves. They don't have letdown games. They might let down for a half. Third quarter, they will always come out and lay the smack down. I've never seen anything like that.
You made a point that, you know, we've been making on, it's funny because we have the Celtics Radio Network, which is very well received as a very small, it's almost like a little cult thing, whereas when you say it, the whole world hears it. But you make the point about, you know, again, that we have been making all along, but nobody heard it, which is that in the games that you would see where they were challenged, and it started with the game after they got crushed in Indiana, they went into Houston on election night, and that was the first of a series of games they played against these teams that have sort of been challengers to their throne. A lot of them had a series of them against those teams looking for what I call the last spot in the Final Four right now. But you have the Lakers and the Cavs, obviously, the other two teams. And all these other teams, it's been this procession into Boston. We saw Orlando, we saw Portland, we saw Utah, we saw New Orleans, all these challengers to that number four spot. And, you know, New Orleans game was reasonably close in the fourth quarter, but the rest of them, the Celtics have played their best against the better teams. And I don't know if that bodes real well for the Lakers on Thursday.
I don't think it does. And, you know, my favorite basketball book ever, Breaks of the Game, and there's this famous, there's a story that he tells about the year after they won in 77 when they go and they just kill the Sixers, I think it was. And after the game, Lloyd Neal, who is this outspoken guy, a bench guy, and he goes in the locker room and he says, "Now that's why we're the effing champs." He doesn't use effing. He says the swear word. But that sentence really tells you what you have with your team that's defending the title. Like, do they embrace that? Do they like bringing the belts to either their own place or another place with a team that wants to knock them off and lay the smackdown? The Celtics, by my count, are 9-0 in those games this year where they had to bring the belts and lay the smackdown.
One of the elements of winning a championship, they always tell you, well, every game's tough because you're the defending champ, but everyone gets up for you. Well, if Kevin Garnett is at the centerpiece of a team like that, that is a good thing because these games, in a year in which we've got, you know, the economic situation in the country and ticket sales are down in a lot of cities, the Celtics are playing to a sold-out house every night because they are the team. They are the Jordan Bulls. They are the attraction in the NBA. And so every game becomes a big game, but on the other side, on the Celtics bench, in locker room, you have big game players who thrive in those situations. So it's playing to their strength. And when they, you know, when they lose some games here, it's more likely going to be games like the game at Indiana that they lose than these, you know, hardcore major challenge games.
Or like a game that when they had that back-to-back and the second night was Charlotte, a team that just randomly just always gets up for them, but we could kind of mail it in. And yeah, it'll be those, but they've had a knack for pulling those out too, which is.
And if people are thinking about the record, the schedule is fair. You know, everyone's talking about the Laker game. If the Celtics win, obviously, as we tape, if they beat the Sixers and they go into the big Christmas Day game and they win that game, the Celtics have a bunch of games on the road coming up, but a lot of them against sub-500 teams. The next seven or eight games leading into the Cleveland game, that second Friday night in January, is primarily losing teams. There's New York on the schedule, Washington on the schedule, Charlotte. I think a danger game if you're looking for the streak to end, if you're not looking at the Laker game, would be the last game of the trip is in Portland.
I was going to say.
The Blazers are playing better. That's probably the one that jumps off the schedule. But, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility in this ultimate one-game-at-a-time mentality they seem to have conjured.
I have two games circled, 12:30, Portland, and 1:09, Cleveland.
Yep.
And then after that, and I sent this email to my friends last week because I, for whatever reason, everybody made such a big deal about the Houston streak, and the Celtics streak really has not even become a national story yet.
Yeah.
If they beat, I think when they beat the Lakers on Christmas, and I really think they will, I'd really be shocked if they lost that game, and they'd be so up for it. But now you're talking 20 games in a row, and that becomes a national story. But you look at just the landscape, I think Cleveland will end it if it gets that far on January 9th, because, you know, that's a team that's equally as good almost. And they'll be so fired up, and they have LeBron, and we have nobody to guard LeBron. That's probably when it ends, but still, you never know, you know?
It's a tough time for a Boston sports guy to be 3,000 miles away. I'll tell you that.
It's killing me. I'm so attached to this team. I'm so proud of the way they've defended the title. And are you sitting down?
I am, just for you.
All right. Here we go.
I know what you're going to say. I'm waiting for this.
Let me do my thing. This is my moment of jubilee.
Go ahead.
Just let me do it.
Do it.
So I think the title had a dramatic effect on two guys on this team. The first was Kevin Garnett, who, you know, as we saw in the Atlanta game last week, has now does not get crunch time jitters anymore and actually believes he's going to come through. And you can see it. Nobody can tell me differently. That guy is a little bit different now that they've won a title. The other?
Say it. Spit it out.
I think Doc Rivers has been great this year. I really do. I really think he's been outstanding. I just think he needed to win the title for whatever reason to get to a point in his coaching career where he learned to trust his rotation and trust his guys and not overcoach. And he's just been, I wouldn't change a single thing about anything he's done this year.
I'll say this. There's a learning curve. You know, we don't agree as to where Doc Rivers was a year ago, you know, as a head coach.
We'll never agree on that.
Now we never will, and there's a learning curve. I do have, you know, it's one of my great regrets. I never would have done it, but I had a voicemail from you in the middle of that Cleveland series last year that Bob Lee would have led outside the lines with it if it would have been the lead story.
I mean, they would
have shot like a tape recorder rolling. You know, it would have been, they actually would have put the words on the screen too, like it was a 911 call.
I'm passionate about my team.
It was that dramatic as the Celtics had lost either the third or the fourth, probably the fourth game in Cleveland. But, you know, you have to, this 20th anniversary of Jerry Sloan becoming the head coach of the Utah Jazz, who I think are still going to be a factor, by the way, before this thing is over.
Right.
I think that, you know, it's one of the most overlooked commodities in sports is sort of the consistency and staying the course and, you know, sticking with guys that you believe in. And that comes at a time. Look at what Doc Rivers went through as he's sitting on an 18-game win streak right now, a year and a half after losing 18 in a row. And there are other teams that just at the drop of a hat panic and fire their coaches. How's that working out in Toronto right now? How's that working out in Washington? You know, there's really something to be said for it's become the default thing to do, and nobody ever contemplates the downside of rushing to that kind of judgment. And, you know, when the Celtics, when you win 51 out of 57 and you're carrying the belts around, as you say, you know, you have to look a little bit harder at that model because it's such a copycat world in which we live, which is a good thing the Niners didn't win a lot of games because the Mike Singletary thing would have been copycatted all around the league, but I digress.
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I think it's like anything else. The more you do something, the better you get at it. And I think Doc, thanks to the experience last year, thanks to the veterans that he has, thanks to the defense, has kind of allowed to graduate into the coach he is now. And I still think he did a terrible job the first 3 years. I still think he was a liability last year. All I can tell you is this year the guy's been amazing, and I think now he is at the level of the Popovich, whatever level. I just think he's been great.
Well, sticking with him helps, and we all get better at what we do when you keep doing it over and over again.
Well, the fact that he's stuck with, you know, his rotation, he brings the same guys in at the same time every day, which is all I ever wanted. He does it consistently. He doesn't breathe down Rondo's neck. he's making the right moves at the right times. The team has the right personality. They've shown up for every game. You know, to keep them that motivated the year after the title, I know Garnett has a lot to do with it, but you got to reward the coach. I think he's been great. So there you go.
As long as you can play that back when they're down like 2-1 to Orlando in the second round of the playoffs and you're in full panic mode, we're going to run
that.
I think
this team, the experience of last year and having to fight through that Hawks series and that Cavs series, I think fundamentally changed them for the better.
I agree. The early rounds will not be a problem for the Celtics this year. It's going to be that Cleveland series and, you know, where is that seventh game going to be this year?
All right, final thing. Give me a prediction for wins. Barring injury.
Well, that's a huge, huge thing because I still would be concerned about the Celtics depth. And I'm a pro Stephon Marbury guy, as crazy as that sounds. You know, I'd love to see a Joe Smith or somebody like that be this year's PJ Brown. But that said, it's hard to imagine this team right now not surpass. I don't think they win 70.
So sorry we had to cut out the end of Sean's point there. We had a little technical difficulties. We ran out of tape, had to put a new one, and then the system kind of crashed, and by the time we fixed it, Sean was gone. So that point is just going to hang in midair for eternity, but we'd like to thank him for coming on. Sean Grady, radio voice of the Boston Celtics. All right, it's the holiday season, and I couldn't resist having my daughter on to sing her favorite holiday song, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Let's hear it.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a really shiny nose, and if you ever saw him, you'll even say it glowed. All of the other reindeers didn't let poor Rudolph join any reindeer games. So around foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, it's your nose so bright. Won't you guard my sled tonight? The reindeer loved him and shouted out Whitley. And you'll write down in his story.
All right. Happy holidays. Well, we came close. Say happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Target the Santa. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.